Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 38, The First Monk of the World. In this episode, we introduce Christian monasticism by looking at the earliest known desert father, Antony of Egypt, or Antony the Great. Christian monasticism began primarily in Roman Egypt during the later half of the 3rd century. Monasticism is essentially a type of Christian asceticism, the practice of denying physical comforts and pleasures, such as food, sex, and material possessions, to achieve spiritual goals. Asceticism had for a long time been a component of first Jewish and then Christian spirituality. During the Second Temple period, monastic-type sects like the Essenes of the Judean Desert or the Egyptian Therapeutae described by Philo of Alexandria adopted lifestyles of strict ascetical discipline. These usually included celibacy, fasting, simple living, and separation from the wider Jewish and Greek worlds, all the while maintaining a contemplative life. Although with the rise of the rabbis, Jewish asceticism became less common, many of these practices would survive in the early church, and from there become staples of the monastic lifestyle. Even before what we call monasticism had originated, the early church already counted among its members consecrated virgins, and also prescribed general fasting among other ascetical practices. Perhaps most famously, we saw how early in his life, Origen of Alexandria adopted a strict ascetical lifestyle, which Eusebius styles the philosophic life. Origen's views on asceticism, and his theology in general, would be a major source of influence, however controversial, on the early Christian monastics. In general, the early monks believed their lifestyle was a higher calling by God, the purpose of which was to master one's nature. By engaging in ascetical effort, a Christian could learn to control his or her passions, rather than be controlled by them. In doing so, they were imitating Christ, who, as both God and man, had complete control over his human nature. Early Christian monasticism has left us with numerous texts and personalities from antiquity, informing us about the lives and teachings of the desert fathers, so named because these monastic church fathers originated from the Egyptian and Syrian deserts. In all honesty, early Christian monasticism really deserves its own podcast. There are so many stories and sayings concerning the various men and women who took up the ascetical lifestyle in late antiquity that to give their history a thorough coverage would require a second podcast. As a result, I will not be giving the Desert Fathers the same level of coverage in our story as I have for the other church fathers we have discussed. Instead, I will follow the tradition of the 5th century church historians by limiting our discussion to only the most important monastic figures of the age, with the occasional anecdote or cameo thrown in for good measure. Quite simply, to do otherwise would utterly derail the podcast and destroy all sense of a coherent narrative, with the great church as our historical protagonist. While a significant amount of monastic literature has survived to illuminate the Desert Fathers of the 4th and 5th centuries, the earliest phase of monasticism, the later 3rd century, is shrouded in obscurity. The first appearance of the term monk in the historical record is a legal text from Roman Egypt, dated to 324 AD. The mention of a monk in this text is so innocuous and matter-of-fact that the monk must have already been, by the early 4th century, an established and commonly recognized figure of rural Christian Egypt. So who were these first monks? There is a figure of Christian legend named Paul of Thebes, allegedly the actual first Christian hermit. Our knowledge about Paul comes by way of a biography written by the 4th/5th century Latin church father Jerome. According to Jerome, Paul fled to the Thebaid region of the Egyptian desert, the area around modern-day Luxor, during the Decian persecution, where he became a hermit. However, scholars have long recognized that Jerome's biography of Paul is a thoroughly fictitious composition. If a hermit named Paul of Thebes did exist in the 3rd century, Jerome knew nothing authentic about him. Therefore, there are no solidly historical named Christian monks that predate Antony. Hence, Antony's title of First Monk of the World, or Father of the Monks. The so-called First Monk of the World, Antony of Egypt, was, in fact, not the first Christian monastic, nor even the first Christian hermit. The sources for Antony's early life describe how Egypt already had proto-monasteries, or at least hermitages, existing on the fringes of local towns and villages. Antony apprenticed under these village elders in his early days. Some scholars have suggested that Antony's early village hermits are to be identified with monastics dubbed in later sources as the renouncers. These monks renounced their material life, but did not resign themselves to the desert, choosing instead to maintain active communication with their local communities. This accords well to the description of the teachers of Antony. In this respect, Antony's novelty was not founding monasticism or Christian hermetism, but in leaving local society and taking up residence in the desert. All this finally brings us to Antony himself. In order to understand who Antony of Egypt was, we need to look at our sources. The main source for most historical research on Antony has been the famous Life of Antony, traditionally ascribed to the even more famous 4th century bishop of Alexandria, Athanasius, whom we shall meet in later episodes. Other major sources include 7 letters ascribed to Antony himself, letters by and to the disciples of Antony, and a text called the Sayings of the Desert Fathers. This text is a collection of sayings attributed to famous Egyptian monks of the 4th century, including Antony, arranged alphabetically by the name of the individual desert father. Putting all these texts together, along with other sources, to try to form a coherent picture of the historical Egyptian hermit is challenging. Traditionally, the life of Antony has been the standard basis for understanding the historical Antony, and all other sources were measured against it. From the standpoint of the Christian Church, the life has often functioned as the sole source for the Christian understanding of Saint Antony. Recent scholarship has, however, become more appreciative of other sources, especially the letters of Antony, which we shall discuss later, while also treating the life in a more critical way. The immense popularity of the life ensured that it was translated into the various languages of the Christian world. Manuscripts of the life of Antony can be found in Latin, Syriac, Armenian, Arabic, and Coptic. As a refresher, Coptic is the language of the Copts, the native Egyptians. Recent scholarship has focused greatly on the Syriac version. The Syriac version of the life exhibits a variety of striking differences from the more familiar Greek text. In general, the Syriac version uses biblical language and concepts in describing the episodes of Antony's life, while the Greek version uses the vocabulary of the Hellenized world of the Eastern Mediterranean. This, and other factors, has led some scholars to propose that the Syriac is not a translation of the Greek original, but a Coptic original. Thus, the Coptic text is the true original life of Antony, not Athanasius's Greek life, which is merely a reworking of the Coptic. Some have gone even further and argued that the Greek life is not even the work of Athanasius himself, but possibly one of the members of his circle. While doubts concerning Athanasius's authorship have not gathered much support, the contention that Athanasius reworked an earlier Coptic text in producing the Greek life has found general acceptance. The upshot is that this adds another layer between the historical Antony and the saintly monk presented by Athanasius. To what extent did the Bishop of Alexandria rework and reshape Antony for his Greek-speaking audience, or use the holy reputation of Antony to bolster his own agendas? When Athanasius presents Antony as speaking in the life, how much of this is reflective of what Antony actually said and believed versus what Athanasius wants us to think of Antony? That is not to say Athanasius was intentionally being deceptive, but rather that we need to be careful and not take his presentation of Antony at face value. As we shall see, the great Archbishop of Egypt was embroiled in many controversies during his life, and it's impossible to suppose that these did not influence his portrayal of Antony. Despite these reservations, however, the life is the only continuous narrative source for Antony, and its version of the monastic saint became the canonical one for the early church. Thus, it is worth recounting Athanasius' presentation of the first half of Antony's life, taking us up to the end of the 3rd century. Antony died in 356 AD, and, according to Athanasius, was 105 years old. The extreme age Antony is alleged to have been at his death has naturally been met with some skepticism by modern historians. Most, however, seem inclined to give Athanasius the benefit of the doubt here. Centenarians, though rare in the ancient world, are not unheard of. Other examples, or near examples, include Pharaoh Ramesses II of Egypt and the 4th century church father Hosius of Cordova. It is on the basis of Antony's age at death that all the dates for his life are subsequently calculated. Therefore, if we reject Athanasius' testimony, there isn't really anything else to put in its place. If Antony was 105 years old at the time of his death, then his birth can be placed around 251, during the time of the Decian persecution and the episcopate of Dionysius of Alexandria. He was born to a well-to-do Coptic Christian family of a Nile village, and grew up during the Little Peace of the Church, ushered in by Gallienus' legalization of Christianity in 260. When he was around 18 or 20 years old, his parents died, leaving him with a large family farm and his younger sister to look after. Less than 6 months later, Antony received his call from God to the monastic life. While walking to church, he mulled over the description of the earliest Christians in the Book of Acts, where all things were held in common, and they surrendered their property at the apostles' feet, knowing greater reward lay in heaven. It so happened that the gospel passage being read that day was the story of the rich man and Jesus from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 19. In the gospel account, a rich man asked the Lord what he must do to have eternal life and be perfect, to which Jesus answers, "If you want to be perfect, go sell your possessions and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me." When Antony heard this, he immediately identified himself with the rich man from the passage. Christ was not speaking to some long-dead Jewish noble, but to Antony himself, as it were. Unlike the rich man, who went away sad on account of his love of his wealth, Antony immediately followed the command of Christ. Literally. He sold all his possessions, his entire familial inheritance, to the local townspeople, and donated the proceeds to the poor, keeping only a small amount for his sister. But when Antony again entered church, he heard the gospel reading, this time Matthew 6, where the Lord instructs his disciples not to worry about tomorrow. Once again, Antony immediately applied the passage to himself. He gave his last remaining assets to the poor, entrusting the care of his sister to a group of nuns. Then he devoted himself entirely to the ascetic lifestyle. Two things are worth noting from Athanasius' account of Antony's call. The first is that Antony was able to entrust the care of his sister to a group of nuns, or perhaps more accurately, a community of female Christian virgins. Consecrated virginity among Christian women was a practice that existed as far back as the days of the Apostle Paul. Like the monastic forefathers of Antony, our knowledge of these proto-nuns and convents is scanty. The second point is the attitude towards voluntary poverty on the part of wealthy Christians versus the involuntary poverty of the poor. While the latter was viewed as the affliction of the fallen world upon the holy poor, to whom the church had a duty to serve, the former was glorified and celebrated as one of the greatest measures of Christian living. Having now embraced asceticism fully, Antony sought out the local Christian hermits on the edge of the village. From these elders, he learned the virtues of monasticism, including forbearance, patience, kind-heartedness, and most importantly, love for God and for one another. After he spent time with the local hermits, he would return to his personal place of ascetic practice, where he would pray without ceasing. Antony supported himself by means of manual labor, using his small income to buy food and give to the poor. He also, of course, devoted himself to learning the Holy Scriptures, memorizing as much biblical literature as he possibly could. It was at this point, Athanasius says, that the devil and his minions began their attack on Antony. The picture of the monk as a spiritual gladiator who engages the demons in epic battles using the weapons of prayer, fasting, and the scriptures would become one of the stock themes of early monastic literature. Athanasius's depiction of Antony's spiritual warfare became the archetype for this theme. The devil began his attack insidiously. He reminded Antony of his past life, his property, his sister, his wider family, and the comforts of home and food. The enemy then displayed the frailty of the human body, and the length of time it would need to endure if Antony was to continue being a monk for the rest of his days. But these measures failed in the face of Antony's determination, and so the devil turned to a baser tactic, the spirit of fornication. He attacked the monk night and day with sexual thoughts, attempting to fill Antony's mind with lustful fantasies. As might be expected for any mortal man, the struggle was a hard one for Antony, but his weapons of prayer, fasting, and scripture preserved him. When the enemy attempted to fill his thoughts with sexual sin, Antony countered by filling his mind with Christ and remembering the fires of the next world. At last, the devil was defeated, unable to continue the battle. He appeared to Antony in the guise of a racial stereotype, a black Ethiopian boy, symbolizing the darkness of his soul and his childish weakness. Although Antony was glad Christ had granted him victory over the evil one, he knew the enemy was still out there, and the temptation of sin would always be constant. So he began practicing an even more austere asceticism in order to bring his body into submission. He ate at most once a day, and sometimes every other day. He kept nocturnal vigils, and would even go entire nights without sleeping. He detached himself further from the world, even ignoring time itself. The villagers were amazed by the zeal and ease with which Antony embraced these measures, but he was determined to master his human nature and lay low the body's desires on behalf of his soul. According to Athanasius, Antony succeeded, and his austere asceticism allowed him to master himself. He was now ready to do battle once more with the demons. So Antony journeyed to the nearby pagan necropolis and locked himself inside one of the tombs. He sustained himself on small rations of food brought to him periodically by a friend. The devil grew enraged and unleashed his demonic minions upon Antony, ordering them to attack the monk and cause him as much pain as physically possible. But the next day, his friend providentially came by with Antony's ration and found the hermit's body seemingly lifeless. His friend brought Antony's body back to the village, where the monk's kinsfolk and other locals gathered around him, thinking their beloved Antony was dead. But finally, he regained consciousness at midnight. Antony asked his friends to carry him back to the necropolis and deposit him in the tomb. He was so badly beaten that he couldn't walk. But once he was back in the tomb, Antony prayed to God and then shouted out to the demons that he was still here and nothing could separate him from the love of Christ. So the demons attacked him once more, this time with such ferocity it was as if an earthquake had shook the necropolis. In the forms of lions, bears, bulls, serpents, and wolves, the demons penetrated the tomb and attacked Antony. But the hermit withstood their assault, and God delivered him from his pain. A light showed through a hole at the top of the tomb, and the wicked spirits fled. Like Christ on the cross, Antony cried out to God, asking why hadn't he been there earlier. God responded that he was always there, and now that, like Abraham, he had seen Antony's faithfulness, and he would always be Antony's helper and make him renowned throughout the world. More emboldened in his faith than ever, It was at this point that Antony, now about 35 years old, decided to make his home in the desert. He went back to his village elder and begged him to join him, but the old monk refused on account of his age and the novelty of desert hermetism. So Antony set out alone to the desert, heading towards the mountain of Pisper, which lay on the east bank of the Nile, about 50 miles south of Memphis. I've posted a map of Egypt up on the blog site to help you out with the geography. Although he faced some trickery from the devil on the way, Athanasius says he overcame the enemy with ease. Finally, Antony arrived at an abandoned military barracks on Pisper. Upon entering, Athanasius says the serpents living there fled before Antony. The young monk also found fresh water, and he stored up 6 months' worth of food in an upstairs pantry, which he accessed only twice a year. The demons who infested the ruined fortress protested Antony taking up residence in their territory, but they were powerless against him. Antony's friends and would-be followers came periodically to check on him. They would hear a large commotion of malevolent voices assailing Antony, which they at first thought were men, until realizing that these were the demons, causing them great fear. But Antony instructed them to make the sign of the cross, which kept the demons away. For the next 20 years, Antony would remain in the abandoned fort of Mount Pisper. It was here that Antony truly became a hermit, and specifically an anchorite, one who withdraws from the world into solitude. It is unclear if Antony was the first anchorite. After all, the village elder monks, while hermits, were not isolated from either their hometowns or each other. But whether or not he was the first anchorite matters little. Antony would soon be seen as the founder of anchoritic monasticism, the first of the two types of monasticism, the other being cenobitic or communal, where groups of monks live together in common, something we shall discuss in a future episode. With that, we end our retelling of Athanasius' account of the first half of Antony's life. As I mentioned before, although Athanasius' Life of Antony is the most famous of our sources, there are others. The letters of Antony are perhaps the most intriguing, and arguably the most important. If the letters attributed to Antony are actually authentic, then it is the letters which should be given priority among our historical sources. In recent decades, the tide of scholarly opinion has shifted decidedly towards the letters being authentic, and thus by implication, they need to take priority over the life of Antony. The relationship of the letters to the life is further complicated by the fact that each presents different portraits of Antony and different theologies. That is not to say they wholly contradict each other, but there are real differences, some of which are quite profound. Typically, Athanasius' Antony is viewed as an illiterate hermit, strongly infused with the biblical tradition, but uninfluenced by Greek thought. Indeed, this is the way many of the early desert fathers are portrayed. Simple, uneducated persons who, although they lack a formal Greek education, possess knowledge greater than any philosopher on account of being steeped in the Bible and their spiritual closeness to God. In contrast, the Antony of the letters appears to have at least a basic acquaintance with Greek thought. In the letters, Antony's central theological concern is gnosis, knowledge. In particular, the knowledge of oneself and how that brings man close to God. For by knowing themselves, the Christian understands his or her nature, and therefore their creator. The emphasis on gnosis does not sit well with that of the unlettered biblical hermit Athanasius describes. Instead, Antony in his letters bears stronger affinities to Clement and Origen of Alexandria. Some scholars have even described Antony as an Originist. His letters seem to assume an Originist view of the world, that originally creation consisted of pre-existent minds which fell away from God. For the Antony of the letters, self-knowledge is the way of salvation and the way of return to the original, rational state of creation. This idea of creation needing to be restored to its rational state is found in the later parts of the life when Antony debates pagan philosophers. But the schema of salvation is quite different. For the Antony of the Letters, the history of salvation is the history of God's overtures to fallen humanity, from Moses to the prophets to Christ. For the Antony of Life, however, salvation is about Christ's victory over death. Athanasius maintains a strict Christocentric theology in the life. The text is always quick to point out that it is not Antony who has spiritual power in and of himself, but Christ acting through Antony. The emphasis is on what Christ does through his servants. In contrast, Antony in his letters is focused on the coming of Jesus and his mission for the world. Another interesting difference is the role that Christ plays in the life as the one who, through asceticism, restores the body and soul. In Antony's letters, it is the Holy Spirit who performs this function. When it comes to demons, the image of Antony engaged in quasi-physical battle with the evil spirits contrasts sharply with the demonology of the letters. While the demons in the life are physical and visible, even going so far as to assault Antony, the demons as described by Antony in his own letters are invisible and need human beings to act in the physical world. Despite these differences, however, there is much between the life and the letters which complements and agrees with each other. In terms of biographical details, there are hardly any in the letters, and nothing which appears to contradict the narrative given by Athanasius. Though Athanasius is often read as saying Antony was illiterate, this is an overreading of the text. The life even makes mention of Antony writing, or at least dictating, letters and communicating via that means. Rather, Athanasius is saying that Antony is different from a Greek philosopher, whose knowledge comes from Greek literature, not, as both the life and the letters agree, the knowledge within, which is ultimately from the kingdom of God within the believer. Both interact with Greek thought, but in different ways. Athanasius presents Antony in terms that appeal to a Hellenized audience, while the letters draw from the Hellenized and Origenist theology of Christian Egypt. Nevertheless, both texts are thoroughly biblical. The life is saturated with references and quotations of the biblical texts, from the call of Antony when he hears the passage from the Gospel of Matthew, to the way Athanasius models the disputes of Antony and the philosophers on those of Jesus and the Pharisees. The letters are also deeply rooted in a biblical spirituality. Nearly all the letters summarize salvation history by covering Moses and the prophets of the Old Testament and concluding with Christ in the New. While it is not clear to what extent Antony was exposed to Greek texts, he could have just as easily been influenced by contemporary Alexandrian theology, the scriptures are the only works his letters quote, and they are quoted profusely. Though Athanasius has no doubt transformed the teacher of self-knowledge found in the letters into the deeming-fighting, anchoritic archetype of the life, there is still much we can learn about who the historical Antony of Egypt was, and why the Coptic hermit became so renowned in the Christian church. As always, thank you for listening. Next episode is the last one before our narrative break episode series. We'll be covering everything from the Bible to theology to the church's relationship with non-Christians in the first three centuries. You can ask me just about anything, and I'll try to incorporate your questions into my research or include them in the Q&A episode at the end. So don't forget to send in your questions and requests. You can email me at historyoftheearlychurch@gmail.com, post a comment on the Facebook page, facebook.com/earlychurchpodcast, or post a comment on the blog site, historyoftheearlychurch.wordpress.com.